My name is Emma Martin, and this is the Lazy Keto Mum Podcast. If you are looking for help with keto and low carb, you have come to the right place. Well, hello, Dr. Sarah Hancock. Thank you so much for agreeing to speak to me. How are you today?
Great, thanks, Emma, and good afternoon. Well, it's still good morning over there at the moment. We might be ticking through to the afternoon fairly soon for you, but it's well and truly a nice sunny afternoon in New Zealand.
Sunny in New Zealand, now there's
a thing. I know, we've had a lot of rain, but the sun's out for now, so better enjoy it.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for agreeing to meet with you. I first met you, I saw you speak at Low Carb Down Under conference on the Gold Coast about maybe 2 or 3 months ago, maybe more.
Yeah, a couple of months ago now, yeah.
Well, you made a really big impact on me. And the reason for that was you were speaking about dental caries and how dental health starts from the inside rather than traditionally what we believe on the outside. So the topic of your presentation was about, I guess, the inflammatory cycle and what we can do differently to improve our dental health. Is that a fairly reasonable synopsis of that?
That's a pretty good synopsis of the presentation. Yeah, sort of looking at, okay, we've got this public health challenge of poor dental health, especially in New Zealand. The taxpayer spends $150,000 a day on the extraction of multiple teeth under general anaesthetic for preschoolers, you know, so that's a lot of decayed teeth. And so there's about 30 kids a day undergoing this operation in New Zealand.
Did you say a day?
A day, yeah. Oh, so that's about several thousand children in New Zealand undergo this operation each year.
Wow, that is huge. And what did you say the cost was a day?
It's about $150,000 per day, because it's an operation in which kids are having to do an overnight stay in the hospital, and so that's around $5,500, $6,000 per child, yeah, for that operation. It's a serious problem. It costs a lot of money. It's entirely preventable. And then during that presentation, went into, okay, well, this is how caries occurs. It's typically thought of as a within mouth response to the fermentation of carbohydrates by bacteria and the resultant production acid that causes erosion. But yeah, there's another branch to the whole story, and that it's the vulnerability of the tooth through malnourishment because of a systemic inflammatory response to the modern dietary lifestyle of a high and frequent intake of refined carbohydrates. And that includes foods that are not necessarily regarded as usual culprits. I mean, we know that sweet foods, like when sweet drinks, like your Coca-Cola, Fanta, all those drinks, and chocolate sweets, all the rest of it. But there's also a role that's played by refined starchy foods like various breads, cereals, other savory snacks that are not regarded as sweet, but there's an effect that the starch has on the retention of the sugars in the mouth and on the teeth, and the decrease in pH in the mouth to that level in which enamel demineralization happens as well too. But just that high and frequent intake of refined carbohydrates has a pretty horrific effect in the mouth.
Which is exactly what we've been told to do for 50 years, eat more. Eat more starchy carbs or eat more refined carbohydrates, more grains, more cereals. At the same time, they took the fat out, and now we've got this issue. So what I think is really interesting is that we think that if we've got cavities or caries, we think that just brushing our teeth and flossing is going to impact that. But what you were saying was that it's so much more. And so when you were saying that we're eating frequently, how did the refined carbohydrates make the mouth or the caries more frequent? Like, how does that lead to that?
How does it lead to it? Well, if we look at the outside-in process by which we typically regard caries as occurring, so we eat sugars, and that's including your breads and your cereals and muesli bars and dried fruit. And so those sugars in the mouth mean that they're metabolized by bacteria that are part of the oral biome, and they've sort of been there in all points in human civilization. But what happens is you get this proliferation of the Streptococcus mutans and Lactobacilli and Bifidobacterium that actually then metabolize those carbohydrates and produce acids. And that drops the pH of the mouth and the oral biome down to a below a critical level of 5.5, at which point enamel demineralization takes place. And so what happens then is you're going to get this erosion of enamel, and you first see that in the dental caries as a process. It starts off with the white spot lesions on teeth, and then there's progress to cavitation over time where the holes don't get repaired. But so at early stages of the caries process, your saliva can remineralize your teeth. Okay, so that's quite important. It's like we have three different salivary glands, parotid glands, the largest one. And so you can actually slosh some saliva around your mouth and you're remineralizing your teeth. And so it's typically thought that that sort of that cycle of demineralization when you eat carbs and produce sugars, and then the remineralization, which occurs with you have saliva in your mouth and there's that washout period, actually helps remineralize your teeth because your saliva has calcium and phosphate and a little bit of fluoride in it. And then that can sort of prevent caries. And so the dietary behavior is quite important. So if you're frequently snacking on refined carbs, you're going to have less of this washout effect in the mouth. The pH of the mouth remains below that critical level, and you're going to have that going on as well too. However, we do know that acid appears in the mouth due to a range of causes, like people who have gastrointestinal reflux, they have acid in the mouth, but doesn't result in that same distraction of the tooth. We know that a certain pattern of enamel erosion is how dentists often diagnose the eating disorder bulimia, because mm-hmm. there's a certain pattern there. But also, you know, citrus drinks and the consumption of, say, lemon juice is also associated with enamel erosion, but again, there's not that decaying from the inside out and the distraction of the tooth. It's just, you know, called enamel erosion. So started looking at that a little bit more and looking at systemic inflammation and the effect of that on the gland function. And then that sort of led down a road of, you know, finding out that the parotid gland that also governs the secretion of dentinal fluid, which actually is the means by which a tooth is nourished internally through the pulp and then up into the dentin, which is non-vascularized. And yeah, so you've got the very hard enamel on the outside. Then you have the dentin, which is the layer of tooth underneath the enamel. And that's enamel's the hardest substance in your body, and it needs to be because it's got to be pretty tough. We're grinding food, yeah, chewing, but, you know, so the bacteria there are helping to keep that healthy. But when you've got a acidic response and this enamel erosion, but the internal process is that a modern dietary lifestyle, particularly associated with Western dietary eating patterns, means that we've got this parotid hormone flow is governed by the hypothalamus. And with that, the intake of sugar, it produces, there's glycation, but it means that the mitochondria of the hypothalamus, the metabolism of that is increased. You produce reactive oxygen species, and that inflammatory cycle has an effect then on the parotid gland secretion of parotid hormone, which then interferes with that dentinal fluid flow, shuts it off or reverses it. So the tooth isn't actually getting nourished, it's actually becoming malnourished. And, you know, the fat-soluble vitamins that your tooth needs, such as vitamin D, vitamin K2, vitamin A and E, well, that's interfered with. And so you've got a vulnerable tooth then, and that's the process by which caries occurs. So essentially, you know, the enamel erosion continues on apace because of the high and frequent intake of carbohydrates. There's invading microbes that then start attacking the dentin. The immune system within the dentin, the odontoblasts, well, they need vitamins to be able to function properly. And then, but if they're not, if it's a malnourished tooth, that's when we see the destruction of the tooth and the progression of a lesion to a full hole in the tooth and cavitation, which then requires filling. Yeah.
That's crazy that that process is happening in young preschoolers. Yeah. And needing to be dealt with. And it really, I guess, you know, it hits home just that that's a massive cost. But what's the cost to the child as well? So I guess they've got sore teeth and they're not eating.
Oh, it's awful for the children because, you know, from a very early age, if they, you know, which is, you know, where you see the severe early childhood caries because of, you know, inappropriate bottle feeding or whatever. And what happens is they might have already been born vitamin deficient, like that. And if so, if we, what we know that vitamin D deficiency is associated with poor enamel formation in the mouth of young children and an increased risk of caries or with greater caries burdens, which is the dental epidemiology with which we should regard all this. So what happens then is they don't have the language skills when they're really young to be able to tell anyone that their teeth are hurting. And so how that plays out is they become a little bit skinny and malnourished because they're not eating the foods, they're not able to eat the foods they need to at dinner time. They then get classified as fussy eaters, and therefore, you know, parents start then getting worried that they're not eating enough. And so then there's a snacking regime comes in where the kids are encouraged to graze between meals. And that's actually the worst thing to do because the things that they're grazing on are refined carbohydrates that break down easily in the mouth, but they're also a bit addictive as well too. But it means that the children are not turning up at meals really hungry, but there's also pain associated with eating as well too. And that, of course, is then having an effect on their speech development, you know, the ability to smile. It's just painful and it's not very nice. And then there's other concerns with nutrition as well too. And so that's why the kids that are turning up in hospital, you know, very young for this sort of operation, they're often quite slim or very skinny and malnourished. And so what you see is that the evidence with regard to obesity and caries in children is quite mixed, but there's sort of that hockey stick distribution where, you know, they're quite, you know, thin in very early childhood, but by the time they get to later childhood, they're well established with the snacking habit because that's been established, but that's also been established in the family as well too. And they are, you know, then becoming larger preteens and adolescents with tooth decay as well too. And therefore, you know, they're at risk of, you know, further metabolic problems such as non-alcoholic liver disease. But it is interesting because I was talking to a dentist the other day and she said that whole dentinal fluid flow and tooth nourishment just isn't even taught at dental school.
Well, that was the thing that surprised me about what you were speaking about, is I'd never even put those pieces together. So you and I were chatting before and I shared, you know, 4 years ago I went to the dentist and he asked me about the gap in my front tooth and saying, oh, how long's that been getting bigger? And I'm like, oh, I don't know. And he wiggled my tooth. And he goes, well, if you don't start looking after these, you're going to lose your teeth. I'm like, I was 46 at the time. I'm like, no, this can't happen. So we went through all the processes of them cleaning it out and the bone was starting to go. And I remember him saying, it's about the acid. But he wasn't able to offer me any kind of other advice. And my mom's like, oh no, you're just long in the tooth. But when I cleaned up my diet and accidentally stumbled on low carb, just because I thought, you know, I'd tried everything else, all of a sudden my teeth are strong and I've got no issues with my, like, everything moved back to where it was supposed to. So
yeah,
the link between what's happening metabolically and our teeth was fascinating to me. What do you think is happening? Obviously, you've explained that a little bit. Just dumb it down for us a bit. There's an inflammatory response going on inside that's making the gum pull back. What's going on there?
I think the inflammatory response, and also we know there's inflammatory markers that are associated with periodontal disease, such as you were describing with the destruction of bone and the receding of the gums and, you know, that, you know, which leads to tooth loss. Well, that's actually a classic co-presenting condition with diabetes and cardiovascular disease. And so there's been a bit in the literature actually about, you know, whether because there's this association between cardiovascular disease and periodontal disease, but actually what I think is going on is that we've got type 2 diabetes as that umbrella condition, that has, you know, the systemic inflammatory response to a high carbohydrate diet is essentially governing what's happening in cardiovascular wise, neurologically, but also, you know, there's that destruction of the cementum of the tooth, which is the gum, part of that gum that's actually holding the tooth in place. And so with that same sort of distal atherosclerosis that's having an impact on capillary health and kidney health. And, you know, that's having an effect then on the small blood vessels in the teeth or in the gum. And that's what's causing some of those problems as well too. Yeah. Right, and then we've got that whole plaque thing as well too, which may also be a function of vitamin deficiency as well too.
Vitamin D?
Vitamin K2 in particular, because what we do know is that vitamin K2 is really important for the making sure that your calcium activates osteocalcin, which means that your calcium is deposited where you want it to in your hard tissues like your teeth, your bones, your nails, your cartilage. And then it also activates MGLA protein, which works to ensure that calcium is not deposited where you don't want it. Okay, so you don't want calcium on your arterial walls or in your blood vessels or any of your soft tissues. But there is a school of thought out there that indicates where, you know, there's this idea that the calcified plaque, because that's what it is, it's just that calcification of bacteria in your mouth, is actually responsible for the generation of plaque that people go to Lumino, the dentist, to have taken off their teeth, which sort of feeds into that. If you have a clean tooth, you'll be fine.
Yeah, so how did we get there? How did we get from the relationship of what's going on inside our bodies mostly and teeth health? Obviously, it's not all, but most, because now you've got these strong teeth and now you've got these weak teeth kind of having issues. How do we get from there to brushing our teeth and flossing and mouthwash and that'll fix everything? Like, how does that happen?
Well, how it happened, it's really, really interesting, and it's partly tied up with the history of dentistry and how it developed as a profession. You know, that was the first dentists were people who were just able to rip teeth out really quickly. So it developed sort of quite separately from medicine. So back, you know, a few hundred years ago, you know, medicine was essentially palliative care because they hadn't invented antibiotics or anything like that. It was just, you know, the various sort of care that we associate with nursing, for instance. And whereas dentistry, well, your first dentists essentially were your wig makers, your blacksmiths, because they'd have the tools and the biggest, if there was a problem with an abscessed tooth, they'd just whip it out and away you go. Whereas the closest thing a doctor would do to, you know, approaching that would be amputating a limb or resetting a broken limb. You know, they're just going and put it back together again.
Yep.
Or if a diseased limb, or, you know, which typically would have happened with an accident, you know, if that needed to have come off, you know, to save someone's life, you know,
yep,
off you go. And so that's sort of the closest that medicine actually got to some of the functions that dentistry was performing. But then if we sort of like then sort of go back to the, you know, the mid to late 19th century, we've got this idea that Louis Pasteur proposed that viruses and bacteria were basically how disease occurred. So that's sort of that outside-in impact. And then you've got Antoine Bichamp's theory, which was that there's a terrain host element that actually disease will take hold in a vulnerable host, you know, where there's malnutrition or people aren't well in other ways, you know, or are weakened. And so therefore, while these things are around, you know, disease will only happen or only occur in a weakened host. And so what happened was there's, you know, the invention of the microscope and the discovery of bacteria. And then we had all sorts of, you know, with the Industrial Revolution, we had increased urbanization and therefore increased infectious disease. And then there was all sorts of public health interventions by which a lot of that was addressed. You know, we got into clean water, and then there was this idea that being clean and your health was a function of your behavior took hold. And so that was sort of, you know, a few things were happening at the time, and especially with the growth of the progressive reform movement and, you know, some ideology that was taking place that Belinda Feck has gone into quite a bit, insofar as the Adventist Church goes, and, you know, the invention of cornflakes. And, you know, so there was this idea that was sort of germinating that your health was a function of your behavior. And so how that went as far as dental health goes, you know, we said tuberculosis was a problem. And then there was various people associated with that, with a dirty mouth, and that most of the people who were dying of tuberculosis had a dirty mouth. And so then there was this idea that you could prevent that with a clean mouth. And this was sort of taking off in around about the 1920s. And the interesting thing about that, there was also the early vitamin research that was occurring in the 1920s as well. And the Mellenbys, Edward and May Mellenby, who had done the original experiments in discovering that vitamin D could prevent rickets in dogs, they also looked at vitamin D and dental caries. And they found that actually, that if you got some children to, they eliminated the oatmeal intake in children and gave them grass-fed beef and eggs and cod liver oil and fish, that actually you could reverse those white spot lesions on the teeth that we were discussing before, and the kids' oral health was just better. But at the same time, you've got all these oral hygiene schools, you know, because of this idea that a clean tooth won't decay. And so there's the, you know, there's all these hygiene companies, whether it's Pepsodent and Colgate, and they're producing all these products such as mouthwashes. And so the American Dental Association had to make a decision on whether these have any sort of therapeutic benefit or not, or whether we should just pop them in the aisle with the lipsticks and mascara and all the nice-to-haves and, you know, essentially beauty products.
Yeah.
And so they investigated all of this and found that actually there was no real evidence that these were beneficial. But unfortunately, because of the advertising that was being pulled from the American Dental Association journal, I'm going to send you the paper in which outlines all this by Philippe Huyol. It's fascinating.
Please.
And so there was that loss of income, and then there was the fluoride movement as well too. And then, of course, the sugar industry were really keen on this because they were essentially thinking, well, you know, or telling everyone you can eat whatever you want, and as long as you clean your teeth, you'll be fine. And then at the same time, we've got the dietary guide, you know, this whole idea occurring by the mid-19th century that fat, not sugar, was responsible for cardiovascular disease. And so there's a whole lot of things happening that where the oral health idea that diet was the principal driver of tooth decay essentially really got sidelined. And so, of course, then we get to the 1970s when we've got now got dietary guidelines that are recommending the reduction of fat and eating lean meat, but also the increased consumption and consumption frequency of refined carbs. And can you imagine being a dentist if you've gone through sort of thinking that, you know, with the idea that fat-rich products and, you know, your meat was protective? But then you've got these dietary guidelines. You can sort of see how the focus then became on making oral hygiene strategies the prime cornerstone by which you could prevent dental caries. There's a lot to read and a lot to say over that time period. But so that's sort of how we have now got this idea that's the cornerstone of oral health promotion, is that caries can be prevented by flossing and cleaning your teeth twice a day, which we probably need to do in the light of their sugar loaded environment that we live in. Yeah, so there's, you know, there's an interesting history around the introduction of community water fluoridation, which is a public health intervention that essentially has previously reduced the burden of disease in affected populations. But of course, we have all these inequities now of caries distribution, where whether these kids, you know, socioeconomic status is a massive factor, and of course, because lower socioeconomic status is associated with increased food insecurity, and then there's more purchasing of ultra-processed food products as a portion of the diet. And so, yeah, so we've got all of this happening, but we've got this whole corner oral hygiene and those sorts of strategies and visiting the dentist, even as if that in and of itself is going to prevent tooth decay. But 100 years ago, we didn't have dental hygienists and we didn't have that many dentists. But in rural, remote populations such as the east coast of the North Island, the dental health was excellent. And there's, you know, some very good records of that. But, you know, now it has some of the worst health outcomes in the country, and that's tragic.
Back when sugar was still locked up and $100 a kilo.
Yeah, yeah.
Or instead just of simply, $1 a kilo.
Yeah, and it just simply wasn't available. You know, all those foods were just not there. And so people did fine when they weren't there. But yeah.
Yeah, I guess they were eating fresh, real food too. And
yeah,
recently with COVID and what happened with the supermarkets in most countries, like I would go, oh gosh, it's going to be no food. You know, you catch the scarcity mentality, but what's left is the pork belly and the grass-fed beef and the green vegetables. I'm like, yes. So I guess people are now kind of, when you've got that socioeconomic thing, they're grabbing what can sit in the cupboard for a long time. You know, pasta is, I don't know, what, $1 a packet or $2 a packet, and you know it's not going to go off in the cupboard. And I think if you have a choice between, you know, a $20 grass-fed steak and maybe a tin of tuna that's in vegetable oil, maybe you grab that tuna because you think, all right, well, it's not going to spoil. I was at the shops the other day and there was a food donation stand. And they were giving examples of what to donate. And it was white flour, pasta, vegetable oil, you get the picture, tomatoes filled with, Weet-Bix, full sugar Weet-Bix, which, I mean, Weet-Bix are good for you, right? So then if we go back a little bit and we're eating Weet-Bix in the morning with milk, now we've got this double whammy on our teeth. So I'm assuming that because we're our blood sugar's having issues and we're heading towards diabetes, even though we don't know it, now we're putting layers on our teeth that are feeding the bacteria. We've got this double whammy. Would that be fair?
Yeah, that's fair. We did this as part of the PhD. I did a systematic review looking at the frequency of, you know, sugar and starch-based food intake on caries. And it's quite difficult to tease out. And, you know, so there was no real effect of total starch intake because there's all sorts of foods that are classified as starches. You know, there's potatoes, there's kumara, there's yams, there's your starchy vegetables. But we're looking at those processed refined starches, and there was definitely an association across the research with the between meal intake of these foods and caries burdens. But we also found that, you know, when people were eating full fat dairy and meat at dinner, you know, the caries burdens were less. And so there's some protection with those foods. But, you know, with the double whammy that you're describing with the Weet-Bix, where you see there's Weet-Bix that's consumed with milk, for instance. And so it's a little bit difficult. So, you know, because we're consuming at meal times, we might have a caries protective food like cheese or milk or meat with that other thing. But it's that between meal intake. But yes, so of course, what's happening with, you know, when you're there's the intake of Weet-Bix, for instance, in the morning, well, it'll fill you up for maybe a while. But, you know, those foods also drive further consumption because of the increased blood sugar and the increased glucose. And then that you're sort of crashing through the day like that with, you know, insulin, blood sugar peaks and falls. And, you know, so that's driving further consumption. So not only do you have the blood sugar problem, but you've also got leptin dysregulation that also drives the lack of satiety and the feeling of hunger, and it drives that dietary behavior of increased snacking. And then you know, and especially if that snacking is on more carbohydrate products, and then you turn up at lunchtime and have some more food. And if you've looked at healthy food guidelines, you know, you're including these bread and cereal-based foods. Then you get to afternoon tea time, there's another intake of food and more up and down with your blood glucose. But that's also having an effect on your mouth, and that, yeah, you're, the pH of your mouth, and especially with these carb-based snacks, is that that's below that pH level of 5.5 in which your enamel demineralization is taking place, as well as feeding that ongoing chronic systemic response as well too. But so your mouth is a fairly acidic environment for much of the time. What we do know that with starches, you know, like your non-so-sweet starch, and so maybe we'll just sort of, I don't know, we'll pick a particular type of snack, for example, say maybe even jam on toast, which is, you know, fairly, might be a fairly standard snack. But the starch actually holds the sugar onto the teeth for longer, and the mouth remains acidic for longer. And you think of your ultra processed foods, and we do know that the increased gelatinization of your starch or your wheat, piece of wheat or whatever, the more that that's processed and the higher the heat and the higher the mechanical what's happening to that thing, that plant that's been beaten around the place to make flour. And then there's further cooking for it to become pretzel. Well, that actually raises the cariogenicity in the mouth, and it actually, you know, means that the pH in the mouth is actually lower for longer. Yeah. Whereas, you know, say like a very sweet like a lolly, for instance, you know, there'll be a very high level of sugar in the mouth, but then that might get cleared relatively quickly. Whereas with the starch, there's this gradual buildup of sugars and it sort of then just is and present in the mouth for longer. So it actually has quite a detrimental effect on the mouth pH and the, you know, the saliva just actually, there's just the remineralization process is significantly impaired because of that.
And then we just keep doing it again and again and again.
Doing it again and again. It's a horrible cycle.
Yeah. And actually, I mean, it's not our fault. That's what we were told to do. We're just doing exactly what the food pyramids said we should do. So I think, you know, if you're listening and you're feeling guilty right now, you don't need to feel guilty.
You're just doing what you were told. That's a really important point, because when you go and look at the dietary guidelines for oral health, like, you know, in New Zealand, you know, a logical place to go would be the New Zealand Dental Association website. And so you move, navigate your way through to diet and that sort of thing, alongside all the oral hygiene strategies like brushing 2 times a day and with fluoridated toothpaste. Then you get to the diet page and they say, well, for more healthy eating advice, you know, they correctly state to reduce your intake of sugary drinks like sugar-sweetened beverages, Coke, Fanta, lemonade. But then it refers you to the government-endorsed healthy eating guidelines. And I did present in the talk and made a point of picking out the exact phrases that are used and where they actually recommend that we should be consuming bread and cereal-based products, or children should be, at eating frequencies for teenagers of up to 6 times per day, for school-aged children 5 times a day. And they even have recommendations like bread or sandwiches with jam or cheese. And then but they've also got toasted muffins and crumpets. And yeah, they actually then went and mentioned muffins again and made sure that we knew that you could have English muffins as well too. So and popcorn as well too, which just beggars belief. Really?
Oh, I love popcorn. I've had popcorn for a while. You think about what they're cooking the popcorn in at the movies. Oh,
it's just horrendous. But they, you know, but the government endorsed guidelines would have you eating those, or have you feeding your kids that multiple times per day. So we still can't really blame parents for this, really, because that's what all the official advice is leading towards.
Absolutely.
And that official advice is in all the advice that's given to new parents. It's provided at school. You know, the health promotion initiatives at school are all based on government-endorsed dietary guideline recommendations. It's how we feed people in hospitals, all areas of public service. You know, there's that sort of how we and how we recommend we feed all sorts of vulnerable populations. And then that's also another huge topic is, you know, what we donate, you know, for food banks and things like that. And some of those foods are likely to be drivers of further poor health in populations that least need it. And it's complicated because of, you know, it's very emotional around healthy food and the perception of healthy food. And it's actually quite offensive, the idea that healthy food is only a preserve of wealthy people. Yeah. And that, you know, as a society, we should be, you know, doing more to ensure that everyone can have healthy food. But we have a regulatory environment that, you know, we've got these things endorsed as part of dietary guidelines, but there's no regulation for advertising around that. And in New Zealand, it's as bad as it is anywhere. Yeah,
and it's really frightening. I mean, I think in Australia, the incidence of type 2 diabetes, it's like 1 every 5 minutes is type 2 diabetes, yet we've still got all these subsidies saying sugar, 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 grain, processed food, processed food, and you guys in New Zealand are the same. What I like to tell people is if they eat fresh and seasonal, it actually saves money long term, because you mentioned leptin before, the satiety hormone. You're not eating as much. So it seems like it's expensive to eat well, but actually it's cheaper long term because you're not eating as much. So if people are making choices, sorry, you go.
Yeah. It's really interesting. There has been some research done on this. Dr. Karen, or Associate Professor Karen Zinn at AUT, did a study where they, you know, costed out the costs of a low-carb, healthy fat diet. And eating according to that might only be you know, say the cost of a latte, coffee, more per day, I think. But also there's been some research in Brazil which indicated that actually a primary driver of high family expenditure on food was buying snacks and buying sweetened drinks. But, you know, if we can actually eat less food, but food that's actually nutrient-rich and satiating, and that includes your cheap mints and your organ meats and things like that, you can actually finish up spending less. And I've been involved in was involved up till about a couple of years ago in a volunteer group looking at diabetes reversal. And people actually found that they were starting to spend less on food when they were well established in low carb, healthy fat eating, because they weren't having to buy snacks, because what they were eating was helping them achieve satiety. But that's also not, you know, commonly sort of out there as far as, you know, some of the benefits of low carb, healthy fat eating is the fact that if you're eating less and you're not having to consume snacks, you know, you finish up spending less as well.
Without a doubt. We had a buildup of $1,000 left in our shopping account after 3 months.
Wow.
That's a big chunk of food just because we weren't buying the snacks. That was a family of three. And yeah. I'm like, oh, wow, okay, this actually works. But we just weren't eating as frequently. I was buying the cheaper cuts and slow cooking them. So I think there's definitely ways to do it. Firstly, on a budget, but you know, secondly, cutting out, as you say, all those crazy processed snacks that you don't need anymore because everything's working internally. I was hearing you speak about your daughters and how when you feed them up at night, they aren't ravenously hungry in the morning and they're almost organically intermittent fasting until you guys are ready to eat. What are you feeding them at night?
Well, it's essentially, you know, having teenagers in the house, and especially once they start earning their own money and hanging out with friends, you know, I think it becomes really important to control what you have in your cupboards at home, like you might have been all the way through. So essentially, and this was actually really interesting to explore during lockdown, because it would just be sort of like we've always eaten with a fair amount of protein on the table, you know, and you still think as long as there's that, and, you know, ideally from animal-sourced foods, and just have some vegetables and salads. So it wasn't like they were eating tons of food. They were just eating, you know, a meal in which they would be getting sufficient protein and, you know, fat-based sauce and then other vegetables, you know, as we had them. But actually a lot of people don't wake up hungry, and you realise how the school day and how that's set up sort of sets people up for, you know, requiring breakfast. Like I'd say them, you know, we're not big breakfast eaters in our household. But, you know, because everyone's going off early in the morning and then there's this eating occasion at lunchtime, there's sort of just like a whole having to eat when you're not really wanting to. And then we sort of found that actually everyone sort of started naturally doing a brunch type of meal mid-morning or eating mid-morning. And then, you know, that would sort of get everyone safely through to the evening. Yeah, and it was just quite an efficient way to live, and you do realise how much the school day, but also the work day for a lot of people sort of interferes with how we naturally like to eat. But I think the other point to touch on is that, you know, changing a dietary habit is hard, and it does require a bit of support and quite a bit of planning, and especially if that's taking place for people for whom have been on yo-yo dieting and tried all sorts of things for years and years and it hasn't worked, you know, sometimes that can be quite overwhelming. And so, you know, nutritionist and coaching support can be really important in that sense, especially, you know, when you've got multiple family members all with their own ideas about eating and what they want to eat and how they like to eat. And you know, with teenagers these days, you know, they're getting a lot of social media influence, for instance, and different ideas about what constitutes a healthy diet, not only for themselves, but as far as planetary durations go as well too. And that's, you know, that's a thing that's sort of been emergent in the last few years, particularly with this penchant for blaming cows for all sorts of environmental harms and just sort of, you know, trying to source good meat and that sort of thing as well too. So, you know, so there are some challenges there, but in general, you sort of the main thing with, I think, with kids in the house and multiple other people in the house is just control what you have at home and just keep it as healthy as you can. But recognize that we're all human and we're all, you know, operating in this society with other people, but that eating shouldn't be fraught with angst and that sort of thing. And that if you've got nice food, you know, that should be enjoyed and it shouldn't be a battleground or anything like that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think as more people learn to cook at home over COVID, that definitely would, I think, be helping as people started exploring recipes because they couldn't get as much takeaway. And you mentioned the sort of regimented, this is when we eat, this is our five meals a day, we're having this and this and this. And I think one thing that COVID brought the world maybe was a different way to look at things and a different timetable, which I think is really useful.
I think for some people that can depend very much on your individual circumstance and your family's circumstances, whereas for other people, you know, it was a really awful time if there were job losses and vulnerability around that and other issues. Now, for instance, during the lockdown, you know, a couple of teachers at my daughter's high school took a picture of, you know, all the kids looking like the Muppets, you know, on their Zoom class and then published that on Facebook. And, you know, apart from the fact that even though they didn't have to wear a school uniform, everyone was dressed in grey hoodies. And because, you know, autumn in New Zealand isn't entirely hot. It was pleasant enough. But the main thing is that, you know, there was a certain type of kid there. You know, they were all white. They all had, you know, and it wasn't a particularly representative picture of the total enrollment at school. And so you think, well, who's not in that photo? Mm-hmm. And that people, you know, there might be people living in multi-generation homes where the employment is a bit more vulnerable. There's device access. There's, you know, so the inequities that we already have in this country just get blown wider through the pandemic. And, you know, if that's been accompanied by a greater feeling of vulnerability and food insecurity, that's going to drive purchasing towards those snack foods and that sort of thing when they did go to the supermarket. And so, yeah, and we also noticed, like, back in 2010, 2011, we were living in Christchurch around the time of the earthquakes, which was a pretty stressful time. And, yeah, you know, so you have the big quakes, but, you know, the aftershocks kept going and rolling along. And it was very stressful and it wasn't easy. And, you know, we had power shortages, water problems, there was sewage was out in all sorts of places, and it was just really tough. And my youngest daughter at that time turned 5 and had to go and find a, you know, sweets for the birthday cake decorating, and you couldn't find lollies anywhere. You know, people were hitting the shops and cleaning it out. You couldn't find the chocolate biscuits or, you know, because I tried making one of those swimming pool cakes that the Australian Women's Weekly do with the jelly in the middle and the cocktail umbrellas and little chocolate stick biscuits and the wee dolls lolling around the pool. But couldn't find any of that stuff at all, whereas all the stuff you should have in your survival kit, like the tins of tomatoes and your can of beans or whatever, they're still on the shelves, and that's the stuff people were recommending. But, you know, people were comfort buying all these sweet foods, and, you know, the whole quake weight thing, it became a thing, you know, in the Christchurch area, because people put on weight because of stress eating.
Yes.
And, you know, because what would happen is there'd be an aftershock if it was particularly nasty, like, say, if it was over 5 on Richter scale magnitude. And we got really good at deciphering that sort of stuff. You'd sort of go, oh, yeah, that felt like 5.
Terrible.
That felt like 4.5, and you'd know which fault line was moving. But people were giving the kids something sweet to eat to cheer them up.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what Gary Taubes went into in his books about the fact that sugar was one of the last items rationed during Depression era and wartime, because of the recognition at high levels that it can provide a bit of comfort and a little bit of joy to people for whom were stressed and feeling deprived and that sort of thing, which is just fascinating. So that they knew that it was addictive back then, or that the consumption of it was associated with addictive behaviours and that people would want more.
Oh, without a doubt. In chapter 2 of my book, I write about when my grandma used to take us, we used to go to the beach, and she would take us to the ice cream shop on the way home, and that was her way of loving us.
Yeah.
And to this day, the smell of the vanilla and the vanilla ice cream, like, it triggers me like crazy. And for me, that's love. And so that, when I eat that, I'm nourishing me, but I'm also killing my teeth.
And it's also, you know, terms of endearment that get used to describe people, like sweetie and honey and that sort of thing. We don't describe someone as meathead, oh, darling meathead, or anything like that.
Please call me green fetch. Actually,
or darling butternut.
That'll work. My little bean.
There's all this advertising and all the stuff that sort of geared people for associating food, you know, sweet food with comfort. And now we've got, which is what happens at schools, is you have these chocolate bar fundraisers in which, you know, if you sell a certain amount of chocolate, you know, Cadbury will buy your school sports equipment. So we've got this conflation of exercise and unhealthy eating. And, you know, we have Nutrigrain, which is a cereal maker sponsoring New Zealand Ironman, which takes place in Taupo each year.
Yeah. They started doing that when I was about 8.
Mm.
So from that's in our – and my mum fed us Nutrigrain because it's good for you, right?
Yeah. But, and it was seen as a – and it was also seen as a better alternative to having an alcohol company or a cigarette company sponsoring sports events as well too.
Yeah, well, I guess as people understand what food is doing inside us and doing to our teeth and doing to our metabolic system, then, I mean, it's a big boat to turn, isn't it? Because it means the governments are going, oh, wow, we made a mistake, you know, and they've got these huge industries to turn around as well. I mean, in Australia, the wheat industry and the sugar industry.
Yeah.
Humongous. On that, I wanted to, you mentioned calling people by meat names. So the importance of meat and full fat dairy, which we've been kind of warned off in a way, what role do those foods have? Obviously, you and I know it gives us satiety and it's just you feel wonderful after eating them. What role does that have in our dental health?
I think it's the delivery of the fat-soluble vitamins and minerals into the teeth as well too, which is probably an sort of an understated or underrated important factor really as far as the building of teeth than, you know, before children are born, but also sort of through the life course and actually, you know, enabling a strong tooth. What we know is that, you know, animal source foods, you know, the bioavailability of those vitamins and minerals is second to none, really, insofar as, you know, especially vitamin D and vitamin K, and vitamin D is involved in immune function, but it also occurs in the teeth as well too. They're just really important for the ongoing maintenance and health of the pulp and the dentin and just hard tissue health all around. So it's really important. What we do know sort of way back in the, I think it'd be early 2010s, there was a study published where they looked at vitamin D and calcium supplementation in women with osteoporosis. And, you know, so they found that actually the cardiovascular outcomes as far as aortic or, you know, blood vessel calcification actually got worse, which actually put these people at more risk of harm. And that's when, you know, that was around about then that vitamin K2 was identified as, you know, Western A Price's activator X, which means that, you know, you're going to get your calcium depositions where you want them to, but also you're going to not have calcium build up because of how we were discussing MGLA protein before. You're not going to have calcium building up where you don't want it to. So it's really important for calcium metabolism, but you just sort of need all those vitamins and minerals in place to enable your hard tissue health as well too. Along
real
with
food.
So, yeah. So it's just really, really important with meat and dairy, but also, you know, the dairy in the mouth, you know, as far as saliva health is good, you know, there's a little bit of calcium in that as well too. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's
so
funny.
It's important for buffering of those acids and, you know, and just raising that pH of the mouth to neutral levels as well too. So, a vitamin and mineral, a nutrient-rich diet, alongside being really important for your general health, also is really important for your oral health, but we should really be regarding those things as one and the same.
Yeah, they got split, didn't they, from everything
they got split,
talking about before. But and that was the big thing that resonated with me. It's like, okay, the teeth are a direct reflection of how my body health is. And looking back,
and the same way your skin is a reflection of your total health and, yeah.
Yeah, we are a whole. We're not pieces, but
we're
I
not
think
bits.
They try and treat the pieces.
Yeah, it's like, you know, a whole orchestra. It's like a whole orchestra sounds fantastic, but, you know, if you're missing a bit, it might function all right, but it's not going to be operating at, you know, full throttle, for want of a better phrase.
Yeah.
And so if we sort of think of it like that, you know, there's a whole lot of processes that you need a whole range of vitamins and minerals for optimal function and optimal health, which is what we're all looking for.
Well, you and I are the picture of complete health.
Oh, thanks.
You are anyway. So if somebody was, I've got two questions for you.
Yep.
If you were donating long food for a, that was to be donated to people maybe who couldn't afford food, what are the three or five, you can go up to five, what are the things you would put in that food parcel, long life food?
Yeah, as far as long life food, I mean, you sort of think if you're donating for a food parcel, that should be going fairly soon to somebody who's going to consume what's in there fairly quickly, rather than just sitting on a shelf for 6 months, because, you know, we sort of think, well, the need is greater. And so, you know, the recommendations to do, okay, just give us really long life food, sort of then gears people towards donating things that are ultra processed. And you sort of think, maybe if they sort of go, okay, donate food that A, we're going to cook and freeze and then deliver to people, maybe that's a better approach rather than just going, oh, let's just donate long life food. Because what you don't want is people sort of going, oh, we've got this long life food, so let's just stick it on a shelf for in 6 months' time. And so maybe that conversation needs to change. Maybe go, okay, say a tin of tomatoes, you know, that's minimally processed. It's just tomatoes and salt just to keep them, you know, preserved nicely, and sort of head more towards that sort of thing rather than the pasta. But you can sort of see how people go, well, you know, with pasta you can make spag bol and it's a quick meal. But maybe actually sort of go, okay, as far as our food donations go, change the culture of that, because then that can sort of perpetuate this idea that if you're in a situation to require donated food, we only sort of really deserve this cheap stuff. And I think everyone has a right to live healthily and well, but what we've got is this marketing of healthy food. It seems to be based around very lean meat, and which are more expensive. And, you know, so maybe we should be looking at those cheaper cuts. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with mince and cheese. Just don't have it on toast.
Or than jam.
Yeah, or jam. Yeah, yeah. So I think, you know, even the conversation around how we should be donating food should be a little bit different. And yeah, there's a health and food security researcher called Dr. Rebecca Graham at Waikato University, and she's written a really useful thesis around food security and poverty and the impact of that on choices and things like that. And those choices are just so much more difficult if you're in financially straitened circumstances. And what we've seen over the last couple of years are just all these inequities get so much bigger. And so it is an increasing problem. But even I think the conversation probably needs to be had about, okay, what does it mean when we donate food? What sort of food do we donate? And do we need to donate shelf-stable items? Or should we be donating things like nuts, for instance, and cheese or meat packs and things like that?
Yeah.
You know, and sort of having the conversation around that, I think, is just really important, rather than just dumping people with a whole lot of cheap, nasty bread, which is actually not going to be ultimately helpful.
Yeah.
You know, there's the best of intentions, but because we all want to feel like we're giving, but are we doing this right?
Yeah. Well, I love the way you've answered that. And I think that it's really important, especially to change the thought process around what is affordable. Because if you eat seasonal, it is affordable. And those cheap cuts of meat, it's not an expensive meal, maybe $10 a meal.
Yeah, I mean, I try to get away from that, because what we've observed in New Zealand is that seasonal vegetables have been just skyrocketing in price. Mm-hmm. And I'm in the fortunate position where we can afford all this because we're a double income household. But for a lot of people, that's not the case. Mm-hmm. And the seasonal vegetables, you know, are becoming more expensive. And even things like cheese is really expensive. And you'd think it wouldn't be in a country like New Zealand, which produces so much dairy food.
You have 10,000 billion cows for every head of population.
It feels like 10,000 billion cows. But, you know, the cost of food here is astronomically expensive, which, you know, is incredible given, you know, we produce so much and, you know, we export a lot. We produce enough food to feed 50 million people in New Zealand, but so much is exported and the food that we have to buy here is really expensive. Like buying milk in Australia is cheaper for me than buying it in New Zealand. That's just crazy. Yeah.
Because it's subsidised.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh,
So this whole, you know, at the moment, you know, the cost of living here is, you know, really quite expensive, and it's just okay. But, you know, as long as you can sort of get a good sources of animal source protein and that sort of thing and build meals around that can be really important. But it also requires a bit of a shift because there's a lot of people who won't eat organ meats, for instance. They sort of regard that as dog or cat food.
Yeah.
So, and you know, there's getting used to the taste of it as well too, which can be challenging for some people. Yeah.
I'll admit I've got a mental problem with that. My grandma used to make like lamb's fry, which I think is the liver, and it's like just the smell of it is like, I'm just going to go and eat the camembert cheese instead.
Yeah.
Which is okay too, right? Well, that leads to my last question for you. If you had one takeaway that you wanted people to get from this, what would it be?
To eat meals that promote satiety and to reduce the need for snacking.
Nice.
Between meals. That's probably, or especially ultra processed foods. That's two takeaways. So
you can have as many as you like.
I'll reword it. And we'll say, eat meals that promote satiety to reduce the desire for snacking on ultra-processed foods.
Lovely. And that would look like real meat, real dairy, real fresh, proper food that isn't in a box.
Yeah, or if it's identifiable as having been running, swimming, flying, or growing above the ground a couple of days ago. And that includes things like your nuts and your seeds and, you know, various foods like that. Dairy, if you can tolerate it, but fish, meat, vegetables. And, you know, and if, you know, for kids, you know, who are burning carbohydrates but differently, the carbs that they should be eating should be just even things like your kumara and your potatoes. You know, I mean, I'm not, you know, no one's even going to sit here and say that potatoes cause dental caries, but it's the potato chips and crisps, you know, because there's devil in the detail and nuance and everything. But just have a whole food diet that, by which you can achieve satiety and reduce the need for snacking on ultra-processed foods. Yeah.
Amazing. Oh, you're a wealth of knowledge. I could have gone down 63 rabbit holes there. Like, we'd be talking until the night.
Oh, it would. And you've done actually really well, in which we've sort of, I think, managed to keep on topic really most.
Yeah, just about. Much. Which is amazing. Yeah. Oh, thank you so very much for sharing what's inside your brain with us. Like, it's fascinating, and I just am so grateful for you taking time to talk to me today. So was there anything you wanted to add?
Well, I'd just like to say it was lovely to meet you at Low Carb Down Under. It was a really fun conference to attend with all sorts of great presentations. And just thanks for being this interested in it, because it's just really important as far as what we'd like to do in the prevention space that you do some really good work in. And it's been an honour, a privilege and a pleasure to be chatting with you today. So thank you very much for inviting me on your podcast. And I'll send some links through to some of the papers, including my own research, but some of the research of other people who are sort of active in this field, particularly around the fluoride and the oral hygiene space. And if you want PDFs, because I do appreciate that some of these research papers are not open access available, just let me know via Twitter or Facebook and we'll get some of that to you.
Yeah, amazing. So you can contact SJ Hancock NZ on Twitter. Is that right? Yes.
That's correct.
And Sarah on Facebook, she's also there. We'll link that down below so that you can actually see her and follow her, because I believe there's some exciting things in the pipeline. We won't go too much of a spoiler alert there.
Yeah, it's just going to be a place where we just like or I'll just discuss oral health research and nutrition and, you know, sort of have that being a space in which we can have those discussions.
So if they search Sarah Hancock, they'll find you?
Oh, they should do.
Sarah.
Yeah.
Well, I think if I'll link all that so that they can find you, because I think you are one powerful lady worth following, raising awareness. We didn't even get into diabetes. It's a whole other can of worms, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. But that sort of lead on from the dental caries thing in ways that, you know, and so what the research and what the insights have provided is just actually how this is all connected. And that, you know, all these chronic diet-related diseases have systemic inflammation and hormonal and metabolic responses to food as a root cause. No pun intended. Yeah.
That was funny. I wish I could think of something. We'll leave it at that funny pun. Okay, so part two. Amazing. Thank you so very much. Appreciate it.
It's been fun chatting. And yeah, thank you very much for inviting me on. It's been good fun.
Amazing. Yeah.